Welcome to Order Up, the Restaurant Operations Podcast, brought to you by Ops Analytica.
You know that scene at the beginning of Office Space where Peter comes into work and all his bosses are coming over and they're giving him the riot act about not putting the proper cover letters on his TPS reports, and he's going, no, I fixed the problem, and no one's listening to him? Well, that is the perfect analogy for how so many of us get coached in our businesses. You know, especially hard in the multi-unit world, because you're not always working with the same people. And if you're above store leader, you're not always in the location. And so often coaching goes from something that's meant to develop an employee, to invest in an employee, to raise them up and show them love and loyalty. It then turns into this situation where you're just focusing on their last mistake, right? But Ops Analytica has a way to solve that. We track all the metrics on your employees, how well they're doing their job, how organized they are, how they may or may not understand certain aspects of their position. And you can use that data to effectively coach and invest in your employees to make them better, okay? Data-driven coaching is the wave of the future. It doesn't rely on their last mistake or what other people think of them. It's a true measure of how well they're doing, and your employees will love you for it. Check us out at opsanalytica.com.
What up, Order Up Show? It's me, Tommy. I know I said I was going to get better at not saying the same thing I started every show, but yet I do every time. But that's okay. I'm here. I have a guest. Please welcome to the show, Audrey Hogan. Audrey, how are you doing today?
Fantastic. How about you?
Good. I'm doing actually really good today. As a matter of fact, I'm very happy right now, which is, it's a rare over the last couple of weeks, but that's good. I'm feeling good. So Audrey, welcome to the Order Up Show. I will cut out all that stuff that happened prior to this. No, we don't edit this show. So we have a very, like, this is a very journalistic podcast, and I'm very serious about it. And I want to welcome you and tell you that we ask everybody the same five questions, which is, we go through the same progression of questions, and I'm just going to get to number one and let you talk now, because I am obviously having a hard time speaking correctly. So question number one, explain what you do today and then take us through your career progression from your first job until today.
It's how long is this podcast?
It is as long as you want it to be, Audrey. So it could be 8 minutes. It could be 6 hours. We've done about an hour and a half. It's the longest.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I've just had a lot of jobs. Right now, is my favorite job, is what I do day to day. So I'm running operations, at Timeforge, which is a SaaS, software as a service company, that focuses on labor management, especially for hospitality. And that's the most fun, honestly, because, it changes every day and I don't like being bored. So I get to be engaged and wear lots of hats and, solve lots of problems, which is fun for me. I didn't start out doing operations things for software companies though. My first job, high school, I was, my first real job that wasn't just me trying to make side money with some gig I was cooking up around babysitting or something, was actually transcribing early podcasts into web content in the early days of search engine optimization, before people knew what those words meant. And I took out the trash for an office. And this was for a business consulting firm that specialized in ERP development and had a client with a podcast. And I was kind of extra help to turn it into content.
That's actually really cool. That's a very good first job.
So this cool thing happened that will explain kind of the rest of my career progression, I think. So the podcast had a lot to do with business decisions and lots of kind of smart businessy things. And while I was just mindlessly transcribing the words into content, I think through osmosis, I learned some stuff that, you know, 16-year-olds don't usually know about business. And so when that job ended and I went out into the retail and restaurant world, because who wants to work in an office when you're 17? I discovered this weird thing. I kept applying for these part-time positions, and I would have a part-time position with a retailer or a restaurant as a hostess or, you know, as a cashier or something. And I was also going, I was paying my way through college at the time. So I'd have a couple of these little part-time gigs going, and invariably at each of them, within a few weeks, I'd get promoted to a, like an assistant manager position. And they'd increase my hours. And I didn't want that. I wanted, cause I was taking heavy college loads. Like I was in class a lot. And then, my work schedule was cutting into my class and party schedule, and I didn't appreciate it. And it wasn't until after I did that for a few years that I finally realized that the reason I kept getting promoted was because I had this kind of operational knowledge baked into my brain that I didn't even know I had about how things should function. And I had those expectations without ever being trained on them. It was like experience through mitosis or something. It was kind of neat.
Yeah, it's interesting because that was always me too. But I think that certain people, just in personality type, I think people who take ownership of their job and treat it like it's their own business, even though it's just a job they go to, like those people always just, you know, people go, wait, whoa, this person actually does their job. Give them more responsibility, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, immediately.
Yeah. So it was kind of fun, for a few years, just constantly like cycling through those things while I was in college. I also did in there, I had a cosmetology license for a while, and I did hair in a salon for a while. And that taught me a lot. I did booth rent. If you know the salon industry, I went straight into booth rent instead of building out a client base. So, I got to learn all about running my own business, because when you have your own booth in a salon, it's really your own little business at that chair. And so that definitely impacted kind of that sink or swim straight into the fire, learn how business works that I got to figure out. And then in 2010, I came out of the restaurant and retail world. I had been managing a few different spots, and I went to Time Forge, and initially came back as a blog writer, essentially, just helping generate some content back on the, you know, search engine optimization. How do we get this website up and running and make sure people can find the software, which was fun. And then kind of the same thing started to happen. I started picking up the support tickets because we were short and, you know, sometimes support got crazy. And then the SEO efforts turned into bigger marketing efforts. And then I was doing sales and kind of worked my way through all the jobs in the business aside from like development, right? Computer development. We went through this interesting cultural experience in 2015 when we got acquired. And so I jumped around a couple departments with the larger company that had acquired us, and then jumped back to the Time Forge team. And then we spun out in 2020, and I was with the title of solution manager at the time. And then over the past 18 months, I've become the COO here at Time Forge, handling all the operational things and kind of leveraging all of that experience in my weird career trajectory to help other businesses, which again, you is know, my favorite.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what I think is interesting? Well, one of the things that I think is interesting that I want to sort of point out here is that, you know, probably the most pure capitalist job you've ever had was that booth rent at the salon.
Yeah.
And because, you know, you got to pay us $1,000 a month. I don't care how you make it, but you know, that chair is $1,000 a month. And I think a lot of people out there discount those kinds of gigs and go, well, it's not like running a software company, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it's actually just, it's business, right? Like, it's pure business. I've got to acquire customers. I've got to service customers. I've got to make those customers happy so they pay me. And then also, too, I need to get good tips. I have to be super friendly because it's not like there's there's a salon haircut price. I got $80 from this person and I owe $1,000, right? So 80 of it has to go to that $1,000. Plus, I got a budget. Like, you learn every aspect of running a business in those businesses. I think the same similar would be those Uber drivers.
Oh, yeah.
I've never driven an Uber, but you got car maintenance, you got gas, you know, you got to figure out like where the good rides are, what times of day to be there. You know, you can't just go turn on an Uber thing and make money. My buddy James was losing his butt doing Uber, because he just was getting all these short rides in Denver. You know, they would always be like, you know, a quarter of a mile and he'd make $3.50. You know what I mean? It was nothing. Like, yeah. It was crazy. So I think that's really cool that you had that experience. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so TimeForge, we've been chatting on and off on other calls, and you had mentioned you were going to talk to me about the labor crisis. So I'm going to break in before question number two, and I want to hear about the labor crisis.
Yeah, no, it's so we just published this study. So we're data nerds. Everybody at TimeForge is a super nerd. It's kind of crazy. I don't know how it really happened. Everyone on the team is way smarter than me, which makes my life hard. I don't know how. I still haven't figured out how to manage people who are smarter than me. I'm working on it. And we've done a few studies. The two most recent. We published in the Shelby report, just all about retail and the impact of, and I use retail broadly, retail, all retail, grocers, supermarkets, restaurants, hospitality, any kind of retail, and the impact that the labor shortage is having on them. And we've got this abundance of data. Right. And we've got an abundance of different sizes, different concepts of businesses in all sorts of industries who we can leverage. Right. So we can use this data to kind of speak to us about what businesses are actually doing about the labor shortage, what's working, what's not working, without a bunch of guesses, which is what we kept seeing, right? We wanted to be kind of the experts. We have always wanted to be the experts to help our customers figure out how to adapt to different situations in the industry. And we, while trying to find out the answers that we could pass along, we found that nobody really had the answers, right? Like, here is the thing you need to do because the data shows that you need to do that. We couldn't find that. So we were like, okay, I guess we'll run the numbers and we'll see what the data is saying the right answers are. And there's not one right answer, right? That'd be way too simple. but we found the first study we did, we actually partnered with CBS North Star and did some analysis around lots of different groups of data and discovered that the main way that we were seeing employees, like employees who are still sticking around, impacted by the labor shortage is that they're getting more hours. Like duh, right? We all probably could have guessed that. But we were kind of surprised that it was so clear cut. They're not working more shifts. They're working the same quantity of shifts, but those shifts are longer. So what I thought was really interesting from that data was we're seeing the exact same thing that we saw when like Obamacare came out, but the inverse, right? When Obamacare came out, we, everybody across the board started cutting hours, trying to make that strong delineation between part-time and full-time, and hired, you know, twice as many people who were part-timers. It was kind of crazy when that happened. And now we're seeing that same dramatic shift, but back to full-time.
Imagine if this had happened and there was an actual Obamacare mandate.
Right.
What a conundrum.
Yeah. So it was kind of interesting. We probably could have guessed that was going on, but there it was right there in the data. It's very clear. So retail restaurants are adapting by having the people who have stuck by their side mostly, right? Because nobody can get a hire these days. Just pick up a little bit of extra slack, which is great. It's good to know that philosophy is actually working, right? So now we have one philosophy that works.
Can you track and see, do you guys have access to the payroll? So obviously, if I'm a waiter, then I don't know what the tip income's in. I mean, anybody who works more hours, in theory, is making more money, right? Unless they're just sitting around in an empty restaurant, in which case the hourly guy's making more money and the tipped employee is making probably less per hour.
Right.
But like, well, are you guys seeing people making significantly more money? Like, are they, you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're making more money, right? They're earning more money. But that was a great segue into the second study. There was more stuff that we had in the first study too. That was just what I thought was most interesting. In the second study we did, we partnered with North Country Business Partners products, North Country Business Products. And we actually found that one of the ways retailers are adapting in this labor shortage is to pay people more. So they're increasing wages. So not only are people working longer, but they're getting paid more per hour. So yeah, they should be raking in the dough.
Well, and that's interesting because, you know, people, obviously it's very easy to group everybody into these homogenous groups, like every hourly employee, like, well, they all just want to stay home and play video games, which a lot of them did over the summer. And that's why they left the industry or they moved to other industries. But it seems like almost every sort of like, I'd say low skill, but like hourly employee industry seemed to be really struggling for labor. But there are some people out there that just for whatever reason, I got kids, I got school, I'm not going to sit at home and take the government's money. Whatever it is, whatever was driving them, those people who stuck with their companies, they worked more hours and then they made more money, right? So they might've had a good summer too, right? Because they were raking in the dough.
Yeah.
Or make more than they used to usually make. So that'll be interesting to see is as people return to the workforce, are we gonna start cutting those people back down to their straight 40? Or are we gonna keep them, cranking and keep them up at the 40 to 50, even though we're paying them maybe, 50 to 60, whatever, some overtime in there.
Yeah. Or what we saw with that first study was we had a lot more like people who are working 15, 20 pop up to 35 ish.
So they weren't going into OT per se. They were simply going from like really part-time to almost full-time.
Exactly. Yeah. They're just shifting over that threshold. So then they're triggering, right? Health insurance, maybe policy changes depending on the size of the employer. A lot more HR. It's kind of interesting shifting from that part-time to full-time. And we did see full-timers going into overtime too. But the biggest shift we saw was with people kind of going just past that 30-hour threshold.
I mean, especially in retail and restaurants, I mean, you're just so conditioned as a manager to manage that labor to under overtime. Like it is, it's just like ingrained in your psyche to not let anyone go into OT. So I could see that's interesting. I mean, unless you just had to, like, oh man, there's no one here. You got to just stay. But wow. Yeah.
It's
I think I was telling you the other day that my wife like was going to pick up the kids, and she went to the, she was like early. So she's like, ah, go get them some Frosties at Wendy's. And literally the Wendy's by our house had like one employee working. And yeah, the guy was like taking drive-through orders and then running and making food and then handing it out the window. And I don't believe it from like, you know, my wife's prejudging, who knows if this 20-year-old kid was the owner of that Wendy's, but I'm going to say he probably wasn't. But like, you know, I'm just like, are you kidding me? Like, how dare you do that to that guy? You know, like that guy's just not going to show up. You're going to think he's working and no, people are just going to be driving up there. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's wild. It's a wild world we're in right now.
So as you guys, do you guys do with part of Time Forge, do you see applications coming through? Do you manage that part of things as well?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. And that was also part of the second study we did, was around how to drum up applicants and how to get more applicants. Sure. and what's working for businesses as far as tackling, you know, the applicant shortage. And we started off, I thought this part was really interesting. We actually started off that study by asking businesses what they thought the cause of the labor shortage was.
Oh yeah. What was their thought?
It was interesting because it's become like a super divisive topic, right? On the one hand, mm-hmm. we've got, most business owners I talk to, the first thing that they say, is around government subsidies, right? And yeah. unemployment. And then as we kind of dive into the conversation, and this is just one-on-one, you know, chats I have with all the business owners we speak with, you know, then we start getting into kind of the subtle underlying things like, so many women leaving the workforce last year to stay home with the kids, right? That had to have had an impact.
Sure.
And so what we found in this study, it kind of backed that up, but I was a little bit surprised, so over 40% of the people we surveyed said that they felt the government subsidies were an influential factor, right? So that aligned with kind of our expectations. But then we also had folks cite COVID, right? COVID's
sure.
contributing. Candidates are reluctant to work. And then concerns around salary and compensation. And then we left an open spot. So if we hadn't, you know, given them the option for something that they thought was the cause, they could tell us. And we got all of the above submitted. Nice. So what we kind of found was that these responses, the biggest one was 40% with the government subsidies, but the rest sure. of the responses were all kind of tied. And so I think it's fair to say from the data in this study that business owners feel like it's kind of the perfect storm of everything combining together to cause the labor shortage. Sure. No one's really citing just one thing.
You know, that's interesting because, yeah, and, you know, I'm very blessed, so I've never had to be on a government subsidy, but I wouldn't even know how to go get a government subsidy, you know, like, so like, if I was like out of work, I mean, I guess I would go to the unemployment office. And then if they were like, hey, here's $2,500 a month or whatever they were paying, I'd be like, yeah, sweet. Just, you know, and I definitely think like, I know that there's a lot of people out there that definitely thought that was the primary driving factor. You know, I mean, yeah. I've heard it just bandied around, just talking to people like in my area, that was their general consensus. Oh yeah. People are just staying at home. Or they're hustling. Maybe they're doing other little side gigs or something. You know, there's a whole way to, you know, you can just Venmo people money. You don't have to put them on the payroll. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It's interesting, but I do think you're right. I do think it was kind of a perfect storm, you know, or you could say the perfect storm was justification to take the subsidies, right? Well, I don't want to get COVID. I mean, I got a grandma, right? I don't want to get COVID, so I'm going to stay at home. Yeah. And, oh, wait, by the way, the government's paying me all this money to stay at home, and I got to protect my health, you know? So I'm just going to eat fast food and smoke weed and play video games for the next 4 months and just guard against COVID. It's very scary. But no, I think that is interesting. And I would suggest, too, that no owner would have said this, but This is a wake-up call for the restaurant industry. If we're going to have employees, then we better start treating them like, you know, we got to start making their jobs better, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's a reason why. Yeah, there's a and grocery and everything. Like, yes, these jobs, they can be, there's a lot of repetition in them. There's a lot of manual labor. There's a lot of standing up for long periods of time. If you're in the back, there's a lot of grease and heat. And so we better be doing a damn good job of, you know, it's not like the choices are, I'm going to work in a kitchen or I'm going to go smelt steel, right? A lot of the jobs are very comfortable these days. If you're an Uber driver, you listen to your books on tape and cruise around town. You know what I mean? Like, so yeah. We've got to, the comparison isn't like some breaking rocks or working in a restaurant. It's working in very comfortable jobs and very comfortable settings or restaurant work. And so if you're going to get people in for the restaurant work, then you've got to create that work environment that's going to offset them sitting in their couch in their shorts doing customer service on their laptop and a phone. You know what I mean? And so we've got to really, I think, push the career perspective of the hospitality industry and really try to focus on what are the benefits that we offer people, and also how can we attract people and give them stuff that doesn't cost us, that's not going to break the bank and make us unprofitable, but make it worthwhile for them to come in. Like, order whatever meal you want, have a couple shift drinks if you're 21, you know what I mean? Create that camaraderie, you know what I mean? So that, because and really, and accentuate the human perspective of the job, because I'm very good at working by myself in my own house. For years I've done that, like almost 11 years now, 12. I've been working by myself in the house on a computer, and I'm fine with it. But a lot of people can't handle being disconnected from people. So getting them, you know, that social aspect as well. And we've got to figure it out, or we have to robotize, because it's not going to get any better. You know what I mean? It's not going to get better.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, when I was working in restaurants, that was the restaurant employee crowd, and still are, mm-hmm. but we're unique, right? And it had to do with the culture of the industry, and that culture spanned, you know, any restaurant. You could walk in, it's the same jargon, it's the same camaraderie, it's the same pranks, and so, like, that's a perk. And I feel like the industry has relied on that camaraderie and that culture as an attractant to the labor force for so long that it's just gotten to where it wasn't enough, you know? I think it's a contributing factor 100%. And, you know, I'm not super young, but I wasn't old enough to be working in the restaurant industry in the 80s. But I mean, everyone I know who was running stores or units in the 80s, that is still in the industry for the labor shortage over the last 18 months, has told me that, you know, in the 80s, the same problem came up. You know, in the 80s, everyone in the industry was going, oh man, we're going to have to raise wages. You know, the nobody wants to work in the restaurants anymore. And then it just kind of fizzled out. And then we're dealing with it again now, 30 years later, right? No, 40 years later. Jeez.
All right, now. Well, I think part of it too is, and this is where, like, it's so key to have really good managers, right? And there's only so many great people managers out there, but great people managers know how to create an environment that people want to come to. That's fun, that's high energy, and you know, you can take care of people without having to pay them $30 an hour. I mean, money's good, but most of the people that are working in the restaurant industry, it's also too just asking them, hey man, why are you here? You know, like, no one ever wants to ask anybody in the interview, like, what are you doing? Like, what's your goal right now? Like, why are you having to be a waiter here? Oh, I'm in school. Okay. So for you, would it be fair to say that schedule flexibility is really the key for you? You got a test, you've got classes, you know, okay, fine. Then let me do my best to, like, really work with you to make sure that you're getting, like what are you getting out of this? I don't expect you to be waiting tables at this PF Chang's 15 years from now, but if I can have you be productive for the next, you know, year and a half or 2 years, and we can come up with a good agreement on what your needs are. And then you go to the, maybe there's a single mom of kids whose kids are in school and she wants to work lunches Monday through Friday. And you have to almost understand, well, what is her motivation? She needs to make as much money as she can, but she's got to be out the door at 3 because she got to go pick those kids up, right? Whatever it is. Like, but you got to create that environment because it's not always about the money. As a matter of fact, I found that it's very rarely about the money. It's more about feeling appreciated and getting some work that you can do that fits in with whatever else you're trying to do in your life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. You've got to, people manager is the right term. It's, you know, I work with a lot of decision makers in the HR world too, not just ops. And I think we're seeing people really step up and take that role, even if, you know, their title doesn't include the words HR in it. Really step up and kind of Google to discover how to try to do an employee review, because they've never in the history of their job conducted employee reviews or quarterly reviews or annual reviews, just sat down and had that conversation, you know? So I think we're getting there. I think the industry is getting there. I think there's going to continue to be kind of fits and starts while people figure this out over the next while too.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's always been a challenge because not everybody, you know, and not everybody's a good people manager. I mean, if everyone was a good people manager, then every employee would love their job. You know what I mean? And that's just simply not the case. So like, but that's, I think when you're putting together your management team, let's say you're at any kind of restaurant, you definitely want to break down the different like types of personalities that you need for the job. And you go, hey, I need the analytical guy. And I talked to the head of HR for Torchy's Tacos, and she said that's exactly what they do. You know, that they really take the time to look at the different personality types of the managers, and they go, okay, this store needs an analytical. We got a bunch of artists over there, and they're having a great time, but, you know, the numbers are slipping or whatever. So they'll go find an analytical to go in and rein those guys in. But I had never heard of it like that. Ever sort of talked about like that before, and I thought it was really neat. But then I also want to preface it with, not everybody's a Torchy's Tacos that's cranking business 24/7 right now, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And has the money and the time to do that. There's a lot of Burger King franchisees out there right now that are like, hey man, I just need warm bodies to make the Whoppers.
yeah and that's that. Actually, you had asked about the applicant tracking kind of side of it. Yeah, I went off on a tangent. Sorry. The second study we did focused a lot on recruiting and applicants and drumming them up. And since we were talking about culture, I thought this was kind of interesting. So we let on this particular question, respondents could select more than one answer. So we asked them what strategies have been most effective for recruiting. And so they said employee referrals. 70% of respondents said employee referrals have been most effective. 60% of respondents said higher wages, which I thought was interesting. And then 30% said that they had invested more in recruiting. So only a third said that investment in recruiting had been successful. I thought that was kind of crazy. Just employee referrals, like, duh, the industry's been doing that for years, but really sitting down with each employee and going, hey, do you know anybody who'd be a good fit here? Like actually asking that question instead of just expecting it, you know? It's so easy and it's free.
Yeah. And it's the same thing too. Like it's the same thing, but different, but like it costs less money to take great care of your current customer than it does to go out and find a new customer. Well, it's the same thing. If you're taking great care of your current employees and they're making good money, right? Then guess what will happen? They will bring their friends into the situation too. And my buddy runs a sandwich chain up here called Snarf's. It's like best sandwich in Denver. It's truly like my favorite sandwich. As a matter of fact, now that we say that, I'm going to go get Snarfs tonight for dinner because my wife's out of town and she doesn't like sandwiches. So guess what? I'm getting some Snarfs. Anywho, the point here is this. Those guys are making $25 an hour. They're $15 an hour wage. They're getting about $10 an hour averaging tips. And he's like, I don't have any hiring problem. Because when people were making $25 an hour and they let them dress however they want, they run a cool, like, chill kind of, you know, ship. And they make great sandwiches. But, like, for real, they're getting all referrals. Because $25 an hour is real money. You know what I mean? So, like, people go, wait, how you're making $50,000 a year making sandwiches? How do I get in there? Well, I'll let you know when, you know, someone leaves. They'll just ask us for referrals. So that's really interesting. The question I really have about applicant tracking, though, is are we seeing an uptick in applications right now? Like right now, like in right now, like these last couple of weeks, last 2-3 weeks.
I have no idea. We didn't put that in the data. We were mostly focused on how businesses were responding, not necessarily the the stats on the response of the response.
And it's interesting because like that money ran out in September in most states, right? Like the extra boost, the COVID money ran out in September. And it was funny. This is very like, this is not scientific at all. My buddy, who's a CFO, him and his wife were traveling to Chicago and he was, they were going there for some family stuff. And it was interesting because like, this is, you know, just his own personal experience, but like they were checking in at the hotel. And the person goes, oh, I'm sorry, this is taking so long. It's only my second day. And then they went out to dinner one night and the person was like, oh, I don't know that answer. Let me go get it for you. I'm so sorry. I've only been here a week, right? They kept hearing like people in these hourly positions keep telling them, oh, I'm so sorry. I've only been here for a little bit. I just started this job. And then they were in the airport. They were walking by somebody and they heard like, oh, sorry, now that I have to go back to work, or he overheard someone say, now that I gotta go back to my job, you know? And so his sense was, and I'm sure I should ask him if they're seeing more applications because he's a CFO of a retail, like auto business, but like, you know, he was hearing a lot of that. So maybe, you know, and this was like maybe 2 weeks ago. So, you know, give it 3 or 4 weeks of bleed time, you know, hey, I'm not getting the subsidy money anymore. I got rent coming up in November. I have to go back to work. You know what I mean? And it's not like any business is going to be like, oh no, you didn't want to work in the summer. You can't come in now. They're going to take everybody with open arms. You know what I mean? Get in here. Let's get you trained.
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, it's I don't have the data to prove it. But from what I'm hearing from the customers who use our applicant tracking. So like our system's all modularized. So you can just use like a piece of it. So our customers who are using the applicant tracking and onboarding package. It seems like they've got an uptick. But
good.
Yeah.
Then maybe people can have a good Christmas because, you know, the whole kick in the pants thing. So let's just say I try not to be too political on this show, but like the government decides, I think crazily, to give this giant like incentive to stay at home over the summer when COVID cases were down and the economy was starting to pick back up and everything was going. And they basically just gut punched a ton of industries around the country. Because like I've got area managers for like Pizza Huts that are driving delivery because they can't get pizza crusts to the stores to do business. So all these people who came out of quarantine and lockdown and, you know, this horrible 2020, get into 2021, COVID cases start coming down, the weather starts getting nice. And then we have obviously an administration change. And then all of a sudden the government's like, hey, here, everybody, stay home for the summer. And here's a bunch of extra money not to work. And then all these companies that were like hoping to like start to get back some of that money, have a great summer, they couldn't hire anyone. And so then their sales were cut in half. You know, I had a guy down in Texas and like 12 Mexican restaurants, Gringos was the name of the company. And he was like, yeah, on a Friday, Saturday night, I should be running 22 waiters. He's like, I haven't run more than 12 in a year and a half. And I was like, so are you giving everyone bigger sections? And he was like, of course not, man. I'm not going to piss off the customers I do have. I just have to cut half the, I have to shut half the restaurant down and just serve, you know, normal stations with my 12 waiters. Well, that's half his revenue on those nights, which are his busiest nights of the week, gone because people, he can't find people to work. So to say that this doesn't have an impact, you know, on these businesses when you can't actually service the customers. Like, you know, yeah, maybe there's a lot more potential customers out there with cash in their pockets, but you can't see them in your restaurant because you don't have the people to serve them or cook the food for them, you know?
Right.
It's nuts.
Yeah, no, it is. It is completely.
So,
just to kind of piggyback on that, that was the other thing I thought was interesting, not to stick to this study too much. I just think it's fascinating. So half the people we asked said they had no idea how much longer the labor shortage was going to go on. Like they didn't even want to guess. Of the half that guessed, 30, the other half said it was either going to be 12 to 18 months or it was going to be another 2 years. For it to continue, I guess. Isn't that crazy? Nobody was like an optimist. Not a single respondent.
Yeah, because they've been beaten down by the world.
Yeah.
Jeez Louise. Man, that's tough. Oh, that's horrible. I hope not.
God. Yeah.
Because you know what? Don't you think everything sucks now? Like, I hate to be like a total jerk about everything, but there is like zero attention to detail. I think it's masks, actually. I don't think anybody's capable of functioning with a mask on. I blame it on masks, even though, you know, masks in theory are keeping us alive. But like order accuracy is garbage, like in the restaurant space. But like just in general, I don't think anybody's paying attention to detail anymore. I think everybody is so distracted from COVID, from social media, from the political situation. I don't know what it is, but like half the orders I get, and I order a lot of food, I'm missing the item that I wanted most. Yeah. Chips and queso, not there. Chips and guac, not there. You know, like, oh, this was wrong. That the guy who gave Alec Baldwin that gun to, like, you know, and that movie set. Nobody's paying attention to detail. My poor mother-in-law, she had like broke her wrist. She had surgery. They did attach the tendon back to her thumb. So then they pull the cast off. They're like, hey, your thumb doesn't move. Ah, crap. We didn't attach that tendon correctly. Ouch. We had to go back in another surgery and attach her tendon. You know, like nobody, I feel like the entire country is not paying attention to detail anymore. And I don't know what it is. But it is real because I see it all the time. You know what I mean? It's nuts. Yeah.
No, I hear you. It's we started calling it around my house. We started calling it anxiety fatigue around January. You know, just everybody's just over, their brains are overburdened. But I think in the restaurant industry, we're seeing so many newbies too.
Yeah.
Like that can't be helping. Because when you've got one new person, right, you've got a trainer assigned to them and, you know, they're kind of shadowing or whatever the first few days and getting themselves figured out. But when like half or more of your employees are all newbies, like how are you supposed to get work done? I can't imagine. I empathize with those guys.
Oh, absolutely. And like, but then also too,
so I was at a drive-thru. Oh, you disappeared, Tommy.
Did I cut out? My headphones cut out. Sorry, are you there?
Yeah.
Hey. Oh, weird. No, my headphones just cut out. Sorry, everybody. I was at a restaurant that's a competitor to Panera. Not Panera, by the way. A competitor to Panera. And I was there and I was ordering this big order. It was like for five or six people. And luckily I stopped at the thing and I started looking through the back, but I had to go back to the person who was the window girl. I had to go back to her like four times. She was missing that much food. She was missing entire drinks, chips, silverware. Like I had it, I go, wait, where is the soup? Wait, where's the drinks? Wait, you know, like four or five times. And she just kept giggling. And I was just like, and you know, the thing is, and for all of you who listen, because you are all restaurant and hospitality people, we know what's going on. Like, we're not ignorant to what's happening in the restaurant space. You know, we know when we, you know, we can, like, I always say we speak restaurant, right? We all speak restaurant. We know when that girl's, like, messing this up, like, she's messing up everybody's order. It's not just my order. You know what I mean? Like, or I know when I see something that the whole restaurant's dirty. Like, I can look at certain things and go, oh, no, we're not eating here. We got to get out of here. This is wrong. Or you just go into a restaurant at, like, a prime mealtime and there's no customers in there. Nothing you eat's going to be safe. We got to get out of here. You know what I mean? Like, and so we speak restaurant, and I was like so frustrated with this girl, and I just was like ready to scream. And, you know, and that's also another testament to things too. She didn't know I have a podcast. She doesn't know that I'm like a hospitality professional. Like, you know, not that I can like do anything to her, but like I'm talking about her right now, and I'm just being kind and not mentioning the name of the restaurant and where it's located. But, you know, it's very frustrating. And, you know, I don't know. This is such a hard time right now. And so much of this hard time has been, I think, exacerbated by government policy and made worse. And there's so many things that are just screwed up right now. And maybe that's why it is. It's just people are just struggling to cope because every part of everything is rough right now. You know what I mean? Supply chain issues, the whole thing. I don't know. I'll get off my little soapbox here. Let's go to question number two, since we're like 40 minutes into this thing. What is the big project or initiative that you're working on right now?
You know, we're doing, so we've got these studies we're doing more of those too, just trying to get more clear data. But what I'm having a lot of fun with, fun's a relative term. So we're actually implementing EOS internally at our company, which has been a ride.
What is EOS? I'm not sure.
Yeah. Have you read the book Traction?
No, but I can't read. Just, thanks for bringing that up. But
so it's I feel like I'm like an evangelist for this program now. So the principles are pretty simple. You know, those are like business help books where it's like how to improve your profit and how to be a great leader and all of those things. And so many of them are so campy. And then you've got this whole like segment of those business books that have like a system that they're trying to sell you baked into the book. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. Tons of those.
Yeah. And so this is one of those books in a good way. Nice. By the time I was done reading it, I felt like I was the idiot because it had broken some of the best practices, things that everyone talks about, into such simple steps that I was kicking myself that we weren't already doing those things. It was just absurd that, it didn't take any extra time. And why weren't we doing those things to actually make sure we were aligned and moving in the right direction? So we're wrapping up that implementation, and it has been an effort, but we're already seeing results, and it's fantastic.
That's awesome. So while you were talking, I pulled it up on Blinkist. Do you know what Blinkist is?
No.
Okay. So Blink, BLINKIST. So my buddy Jeff told me about Blinkist. And so, it's like $99 a year, and, but it is the 12-minute summary of that book. So, and so I've actually been canceling my Audible because I was buying all these business books and then never listening to them. Yep. And because I find that most business books are like 1/3 amazeball and then 2/3 of just beating a dead horse of what you said in the first third. And it gets a little rough for me. But these Blinkists are amazing. And it's an app, and like you can just download them and read them, or you can listen to them. They like record them too. And so highly recommend Blinkist. I don't get paid on this, by the way. Like, I don't have any referral code for them. But it's been like my buddy told me about it. And like, it's totally worth it because you get the most, you get the literal best points of the book. And then if you're like, oh my God, I need more, then you go buy the rest of the book. But
if you, you know, a lot of times you just, you know, especially for entrepreneurs like ourselves, you know, I don't have time to read the whole book. I just want to know, give me these four, give me three things that I can execute that's going to actually change my business. And I will, I can go and crush those three things, but I, you know, whatever. So EOS, Entrepreneurial Operating System, operating system. So that's what EOS stands for.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's the one.
So that's cool. I had another one that we're supposed to read too, which is called Nudge. It's how to get people to do what you want them to do.
Yeah. I've heard of that. I haven't read it. You'll have to tell me how it is.
I haven't either. Well, I'm going to do the Blinkist on that too. So in 30 minutes, I'll have both these things done. I'll give you a quick book report.
I love it. Yeah. I'm going to have to try Blinkist out. This looks fun.
Cool. So you're doing an entrepreneurial operating system upgrade where you basically went through and looked at your business processes and are trying to figure out better ways to manage them. Is that what I'm assuming that is?
Yeah. Yeah. So I mentioned earlier that like we've got this team of incredible super nerds who are geniuses. And this, there's this thing that happens when you're working with people who are super, super smart, where they're really good at doing like one thing at a time. Right.
Yeah.
And if you give them too many things to do all at the same time, not only are they, it's not like if you give them 10 things to do, each thing gets 10%, right? Yeah. Everything gets like 1%. Like it just degrades. Sure. And so it's been really interesting seeing how when we actually focus and we actually talk about the goals instead of just thinking that they're implied and assuming everyone gets it, that focus makes everyone's priority list just like self-prioritize. It's we have fewer meetings arguing about what's more important because it's inherent because we all talked about what's important in the long term. It's fantastic. Communication, right?
Wow. That okay, now I'm excited. I literally have it open on my computer, but I have to talk so I can't start reading. So with my ADD, I would literally just start reading it and you'd be like, this is a boring podcast. He hasn't talked in 28 minutes. Is that normal for podcasts? I don't do a lot of podcasts. I don't know. So yes, that's cool. Okay, that's awesome. I'm gonna move to question number three. What is the one thing in the industry or your business that's keeping you up at night?
Yeah, I feel like we tackled that when I talked about the labor shortage. That's I think we're getting to where it's stabilized, not resolved, right? But I think it's getting to where it's stabilized and everyone is starting to find the things that work for them to get through this. Now I'm just hoping that everyone can come up for air long enough to clean up the things that have gotten abandoned because they were focused on labor shortage problems. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, well, it's interesting for you guys too, because I assume, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but for most scheduling and companies like yourself, time management companies and stuff like that, you generally charge by the user, right? So naturally, if they have less users, you make less revenue. But then I'm sure you've seen this as well as we've seen it too. I've got deals, big deals, huge money-making deals that would be really great to have in the company that just keep getting kicked next quarter, because nobody can actually focus on doing anything but hiring people to work in the businesses.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been ironic. Several deals. We've had businesses, sizable groups, come to us trying to get, go from paper applications to digital applicant tracking and onboarding and, you know, digital I-9s and, get everything cleaned up and streamlined so that they can go faster through the applicant tracking and hiring process. And they're so excited about all the features and all the things it does and automates. And then it, you know, after 6 months of us pestering them about the thing that they contacted us about, because they're so excited, they're finally ready to move forward, because that 6 months, instead of actually implementing something to solve the problem, they were busy firefighting to solve the problem. Right. Like everybody does that at some point, but it's been so ironic. Recently that just has happened over and over, and it breaks my heart because I know what it's like to be in that cycle where you can't come up for air to do the thing that fixes the thing that makes you not come up for air, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, And what's interesting about it is the person who's in that position knows that they need to do this. They just, it's like when I worked at the P.F. Chang's, and I, for the people who listen to this podcast all the time, I probably said this 50 times, but it's so true. Like when I worked at the P.F. Chang's, I was the floor manager at one of the busiest chains in the country, and we were crushing it and we were raising sales and it was great. But like, you know, every day at like 2 o'clock, we'd have an amazing lunch, and then I would sit down, eat some food, and then I would get my list of all the no-call, no-shows and all the people who weren't coming that night. And I'd start picking up the phone and calling them. This is back in the early 2000s, like trying to get people to fill the shift, right? But at that time, I wasn't doing anything to grow my business. I wasn't doing anything to get better. I wasn't training anybody. I wasn't investing in anybody. I was just getting sucked into the fighting fire part of what am I going to do to get bodies for the next shift. And when you spend all your time in that mode, you can't even imagine doing that thing that's going to actually make things better. You just can't even, it doesn't even enter into like on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You're down below the pyramid, below air and like water. You're like underneath it. You know what I mean? Going, I wish I could get up to air and water, you know, but right now I'm just trying to throw bodies into this, into the breach because people are coming in 2 hours to eat here and I got nothing to do. I got no one to serve them, you know?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. But that's also very interesting. So like, not only is that affecting the restaurant, they can't have as many tables and have as many cooks. They can't cook as fast. Their sales are down. Their managers aren't able to cope with trying to do the things that might be smart, like reorg their menu, change their stations, do whatever things they might need to do to try to make their business more efficient because they're so busy just trying to get a few bodies in there. And then people like us who work with the hospitality industry, we're also suffering as well because our client is suffering, right? So we're suffering too. So it's this cascading through the entire economy. It's nuts.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is totally, totally crazy. But I think, you know, next year we saw, I mean, last year was what the most rapid technology adoption across restaurants and hospitality and decades, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I think some of these things, these cans that keep getting kicked down the road that are stacking up, I think we're going to see something kind of like that next year. I think that whenever everyone's able to come up for a breath of air to take care of some of those cans they keep kicking down the road, like reorging the menu or whatever, we're going to see a lot more adoption, streamlined processes. I think the industry is going to be better overall. Now they've got the tools to do it. Next year, they're going to figure out how to maximize those tools and to get those processes cleaned back up. I think.
I hope so, for sure. Because ultimately, as much as I sell to the restaurant industry, I meet out a ton. So I'm also a very lucrative customer. Therefore, I want great service. Awesome. Okay, I'm going to throw in my extra question here too, which is, in your opinion, having worked in, you know, both serving the hospitality industry and also being in the hospitality industry, what makes like a great hospitality company? And it could be a corporation, it could be an individual location. I don't really care. I just want to know what makes a great hospitality.
Yeah, I think, I mean, just in my experience, it's the easy answer is customer service, right? That's what hospitality is all about. If you're not prioritizing customer service in a hospitality business, you're doing it wrong. But I think that great customer service goes hand in hand with having a powerful internal culture, which I think that's an overused word. I overuse it. I think it's overused in the industry. But having, like we talked about at the beginning, right? Having people invested in being there, having your people manager sit down and actually understand what makes the team feel invested and invested in. I think that drives the powerful customer service that has defined great hospitality businesses forever. And I don't think that's ever going to change.
Everyone said culture.
Yeah.
So What that tells me is that you and I both have to shift our internal marketing to be, how does our product affect culture? But because literally everyone I've asked on this show has said culture. And I, which by the way, I 100% agree. I also don't think culture can be trained. I, like, one of the things that I was a trainer at PF Chang's too, and we would spend, you know, a ton of time going over the whole culture of the business and all that stuff. I think culture should not be part of your initial onboarding training. I think that's dumb. I think culture is actually lived by example, and then you can talk more culture on shift meetings than you can, like, wasting a couple hours of training on it. Because if it's not being delivered by the managers, it's just another example of the man lying to you, saying we do one thing and then the manager's doing something the opposite, which, you know,
yeah,
just gives employees reasons to be mad and backfired. Feel like they're getting slighted. Yeah. So, but it's always culture. And I would suggest, so you're the first person who said culture with customer was service. I think most people were just talking more about people culture, like within the company, but creating that culture. And I would also suggest that part of that culture, from the businesses that I've seen that have been the most successful, are the most sort of professional, numbers and system driven cultures as well.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, you go to some restaurants and the guy's just got like a pile of receipts on a desk and you're like, what? And then you go to other restaurants and the guy's like pulling, you know, crazy numbers out and go, wow, if we had just sped up our, like, you know, our turn time by 8.5 seconds, we would have made another $4,000 last week. You know what I mean? And you're like,
yeah,
okay. And so, but definitely culture is the answer. So for those of you who listen to the show, I mean, everybody's saying this, culture. So if you're, you can be focusing on all these other things, but culture is one of those things that will probably pay the biggest dividends, you know?
Yeah.
And it's interesting too, I think, because, you know, you go to like a Cheesecake Factory or a PF Chang's, which, you know, or you go to some of these, like, I mean, blooming brands. I mean, you know, it's interesting how restaurants are the hottest thing ever, and then they get overexposed, and then they become, you know, Applebee's is an example. Like when Applebee's first came out in the 80s and early 90s, especially if you lived in rural America, I mean, that was the place. I mean, I would go do comedy shows up in like Spearfish, South Dakota, and that Applebee's had like an hour wait on a Friday night. You know what I mean? And like, but then they become overexposed and then they're not as cool. But it's interesting to see how some businesses are capable of maintaining that culture of excellence. They are numbers driven. They are customer focused, and they just run great businesses. And they might not be the hottest thing anymore. They might not have the hour wait on a Monday night, but they're still cranking cash through those things. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're servicing people. It's pretty impressive. Wow. Culture. God, so interesting. Yeah. Well, and, you know, too, like my whole app, Ops Analytica, you know, the whole purpose of the checklist, right? Like, people think of the checklist in the industry, you know, people look at checklists, employees look at checklists in the industry as, what a waste. Like, they view them as like meaningless busy work, right?
Yeah.
That, like, and they go, man, I've been running restaurants for 30 years. I literally was on the phone with somebody earlier today. And she was like, yeah, you know, in paper checklists, we just all knew how to like scam them and not do them correctly and not actually use them. And now this is such a shift because we're forcing people to actually use these checklists. And I was like, listening to this lady go, yeah, we used all these ways to get around them. And I'm like, yeah, you did. And that's why most restaurants are mediocre, and it's not the labor shortage. Because it's just, there are most restaurants, like, if you, I have a chart on one of my blogs, but there was only one chain of QSRs that had an above 80% customer satisfaction rating. It was Chick-fil-A. Wow. And they were 81. Everybody else was in the 70s. Top 20 chains, all in the 70s. And some, I think one might have even been in the 60s. I get to look at the graph. But, you know, and so people look at the checklist, and I get it. The checklist, when they were done on paper, no one ever looked at them. No one held you accountable to do them. All that data was lost, and it was just plain busy work. I totally understand why the whole industry feels that way, because, but they were put in place because they are the most effective way to create a culture of detail and excellence.
every item on those checklists is something you need to check to keep people safe or to be ready for guests or to make sure that you are going to have the speed of service so you can maximize that profitability thing. They're like one of the most effective tools you can potentially have in your business. And there are companies who have cultures that like really rely on those checklists. And I will tell you, they are more successful than the companies that can't get that stuff going. And I see it all the time. Like, because I have clients that are great checklist clients that really focus on them, use the tool. And those guys are always in the press. Great earnings, opening new restaurants, just signed this deal. And I have other clients who aren't able to even get their people to do anything. And I can see them operationally not struggling to do stuff. And by the way, those guys, they're always in the news for, hey, we're restructuring and we're laying off and, you know, whatever. So it's just like, I don't know. It's amazing to me, this whole thing.
Yeah, we see that. We see that on our side too, just with the, I mean, checklists are just as core to the business and something everyone should be doing. Just like scheduling. Like it's, it always fascinates me when I hop on a call with a business owner or a unit manager, a restaurant manager, GM. And I go, okay, well, tell me about how you do your labor budgets. How are you budgeting labor, you know, every week? And the response I get is just like you with the checklist. Oh, I've been running restaurants for 20 years. I just know what we're going to need. What? Like, so you don't have like a number that you're targeting so that you can make sure you're actually hitting it. You just know whether you're doing good or not. Okay. I mean, it amazes me.
It's crazy. I call these guys dinosaur operators too. They, you know, these are the guys that started in the 80s and 90s, and then they don't really like technology and they don't want to learn it. Like, you know, running restaurants is about, you know, talking to guests. Well, that's part of it, but like, you know, not anymore. Not when you have 700 units and you know, got a lot of employees you got to pay for. But like, it is crazy to me. Yeah. You know, it's funny because my buddy, he was on the second version of this podcast, and he was a menu item designer. Like he's a chef and a sommelier, but it also worked at big supply chain at like huge companies like Heinz and everything. And, you know, he was consulting, helping people come up with new menu items. And he was like, I'm constantly amazed. And this is like, he worked at Wendy's, I mean, big companies, right? Like he's like, I'm constantly amazed that people just go, we're just going to do a, you know, why don't we just do like a grilled chicken buffalo sandwich this year? Great. Good idea, Bob. Let's all get that worked out. We'll go do a grill. And he was like, you know, like he was just so amazed at like how like just loosey goosey it was. And that no one was, like, it was just like going off a couple of chef's thoughts about what we should do. And like their approach was, well, what occasion, who are you trying to target? Then looking at like, what was it like an excess of like, you know, like during the pandemic, there was an excess of chicken wings and then Wingstop bought them all up because, you know, everyone was doing chicken breasts because they were at home. So there was no one was buying wings. And like, you know, just backing into it so methodically and actually trying to come up with something that would like appeal to the occasion, the person, the time of day, what was cheap in the food world at that period of time versus, hey, let's just make baked potato soup. How's everyone feel about baked potato soup? Is our big thing this year? Yeah. It was interesting.
And those random ideas aren't necessarily the wrong ones. You just don't know whether they're right or wrong. That's the whole point, right?
Yeah, exactly. The whole point of having systems is that we're not just relying off of the genius and personality of just one person.
Yeah.
You know, and also, let me just abuse you all now. I don't care if I've been in this industry, I'm 14, I turn 50 next year. I don't know if the walk-in's the right temperature or the food tastes good unless I physically go to the walk-in and check it or I taste the food. So the only thing that experience in the hospitality industry gets you is how to deal with weirdo situations. That's it. Because if you've been running restaurants for 35 years, literally in the same restaurant for 35 years, then you've probably seen a lot of weirdo situations, fights, coolers breaking down, weird pipes exploding, the ice storm that cut all the power and we still serve people. You've seen a lot of that stuff. So when the other weird situation comes up, you're probably better equipped to handle the weird situations. But it has nothing to do
with your ability to run an actual business. You're just better at handling weird stuff. The day-to-day operations. As a matter of fact, the people that have been doing it too long are the worst managers because they don't know how to actually, like a lot of them, have a hard time actually just focusing on the detail work of the systems every single day. We check this, we check this, we make a labor schedule, we look at our numbers, we do an inventory, you know, we make sure everyone has the right spoodles in so our food cost isn't flying off the rails. You know what I mean? Like those are the things that like a good restaurant manager does. And that doesn't require you to be there for 35 years. It requires you to be detail oriented and focused.
Yeah. Well, and I want, are we coming up on time?
No.
Okay. Well, I want to.
Well, sure. Whatever. This is a very tight ship. Come on. No, we're not. I've been rambling the whole time. I've been crazy today. I don't have my, by the way, I'm out of Vyvanse and I can't get a meeting with the doctor to get me more Vyvanse, which is my AD meds. So that's why this podcast is going in this direction. But everyone's
listening. So we can keep it going for a while. Okay.
Yeah, of course. We got like 10 more minutes at least.
No, I just on that thought, right, with experienced managers and inexperienced managers, you know, a lot of my customers don't have the choice right now. They'll take whoever they've got. They've promoted internally someone who, you know, was a server for a couple of years but never actually ran anything. Whatever they can get, they've got managing right now. I'm proud to say, our head of marketing actually anticipated that, and she put some resources on our website for people who are new to the restaurant and hospitality industry, some like common jargon, things like that for people who were new to management or just the industry in general. So that's handy. But I think those systems and processes for the businesses that had them in place and were holding people accountable to them pre-pandemic and pre-labor shortage, it's been kind of a litmus test, right? All of the craziness over the past 18 months has been a litmus test for culture, for systems, for people, for processes. And those things that were in place already, those businesses that had the processes in place, they're not scrambling right now. Like they had a clean way to onboard new managers and they have the systems in place so that it's just checking boxes or it's going through the same cycle, you know, every shift change or whatever. But the businesses that didn't have those systems in place, whether it was a software, a checklist, a schedule, it doesn't matter, whatever system it was, they're the ones who are really hurting because how do you train someone, you know, especially a new manager, on how to be accountable for the thing that's not written down? No idea.
You nailed it. And like I had to eat some crow in my blog, by the way, and it's on there. There's actually a big picture of a crow. There's actually like a picture of grilled crow on the picture of the blog, because I was really hammering people for years prior to COVID about why are you investing all this money in all these new sales channels and all this stuff when you don't have your daily ops fixed and all you're doing is accelerating. I call it marketing off a cliff, right? And we were the kings of that at Quiznos. We really perfected marketing people off a cliff because we had all these restaurant operators that were broke, that weren't making any money. So they weren't staffing the restaurants. It's very similar to what you'll see in a lot of Subways today. You know, one guy working in the whole restaurant and, you know, line out the door and people turning around. But we would be running national television advertising, driving people into the Quiznos so that they would have then bad experiences, or they would get to the door and be like 2-for-1 prime ribs. And then the guy would have like a handwritten sign on the door that said like 2-for-1 prime ribs, not honored here, you know, because they were just broke. Right. And then it was nuts. And so then I had to eat a lot of crow because the people who had implemented those systems pre-COVID, those systems saved their butts. So, you know, I was totally off on that. And I admitted it in my blog twice now and on this podcast. So I fully atone for my sins there, but you're right. And like, but what everything you just said was so correct. And like, and I'm not just saying that like hypothetically, like I see it because, you know, I see which clients are closing their doors or are leaving or, you know, are struggling. And like two of my biggest clients who also like literally came on in 2020, January of 2020,
had the system up and running and really understood how to use it. Like two very big national chains. You all know who they are. I'm not going to say their names, but like they're big chains. And they just, you know, because they had the systems in place, my system, other systems too, obviously they had other things going on. When the pandemic came, they weren't focused on, they were actually focused on how do we adjust our business to this pandemic so we can keep making money and not have to fire everyone versus going, how do we process orders when we have a pandemic going on? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, because they had the infrastructure in place to make it happen. And actually, both my clients thrived during the pandemic because they did. They were very professional companies with a lot of systems, and they knew how to work them. And they just were able to actually like just do new things and actually grow their businesses during that time. It was crazy. Like, you know what's crazy too? Like I have probably more COVID health screening data in my platform than I don't know who else would have even nearly as much as I do. Because I created a health screen for COVID, like by the 20th of March, I already had one out and people were using it. Like I had probably several million rows of data on just COVID health screens, temperature taking. I have all kinds of versions of it. It's crazy.
That's fun. Yeah, we did the same thing. I mean, it was like the Twilight Zone while we were building it. Like, yeah. No one's going to use this. No one's going to want this. How long could they possibly want this for? Right.
I know. And then also people were using it. You're like, what? Cool. Okay. Well, let's go to questions 4 and 5 and then we'll get out of here. What is the one thing you thought the industry would be doing right now that it isn't?
I had to think about this one, and I mean this in full sincerity. I'm not trying to be funny. I really thought there would be more robots.
Oh yeah.
I really did. I just, I don't know if it's because I grew up as a sci-fi fan, reading all the classic sci-fi novels, or, you know, the Jetsons made a particularly strong impact on me or what, but I just anticipated from kind of the monotony of prep work, you know, slice the white part of the lettuce off and then, you know, rip the lettuce and shred it. And I just anticipated that robots would be doing prep work. Maybe it's because I hate prep. Maybe that's the core problem here, is I hate prep. And so I thought that it would be automated by now.
So it's interesting. Well, I think it is though. I think it is, because so much more food is coming from commissaries.
That's true.
And not everything in the commissary. So like when you have a commissary, you know, like I remember I used to work at a lot of country clubs. That was kind of where I started my career. I wanted to be in clubs. But like, you know, I'd be in this, we have a big city club here, the Denver Athletic Club downtown. And I was in their kitchens a bunch, you know, and those are one of those guys, you know, they're doing so many parties, so much stuff. They have one of those potato peelers, you know, it's like that, you throw the potatoes in the thing and it spins them around and like it just hits like these balls and then it like skins the potatoes, you know?
Yeah.
And like, but that's probably a $5,000 or $6,000 machine, right? You know, who knows what those things would run for. But like, you know, they invested in that machine because they were doing so many potatoes, they realized, hey, we will save money on labor on the potato thing. But now all the food, if you're in QSR, pretty much most QSR food is either cooked at a commissary, bagged and sent to the place, or it's like par-bake, or, you know, or you heat it up in a bag or whatever it is. So I do think that some of that prep, unless you're in a very fine dining restaurant, no one's cutting stuff at the restaurant. It's already pre-chopped, pre-sliced, pre-whatever. But I agree with you. Like that miso guy, his first robot was $80,000. And we were going to the National Restaurant Show every year for a couple of years there prior to COVID. Every year we would go. So the first year his robots were there and they were right in the front of one of the big buildings over by the roasted chicken place, which is like my favorite. Roasted chicken's like the best reason to go to the restaurant show. But because I don't get roasted chicken around here very much, but I'll eat like 70 pieces while I'm at that show for like one day. But like anyway, but his robots were right next to the roasted chicken booth and the well-built guys. And it was $80,000. Now he's down to under 10.
Yeah.
And I got a guy who's testing a robot right now. He's a buddy of mine. And he's testing it in 6 Burger Kings. And all the guy wants it to do is just drop the patties on the grill. He doesn't want to do anything else.
right now. But that's a job that he probably has to put a person on, but that person's like underutilized. You know, even in the rush, that person, how many pucks is that guy throwing in there? One a minute, two a minute, you know? So like, that's all he wants. And that's like that thing that they're talking about today too, with the augmentation, that robots aren't going to replace employees. They're just going to augment jobs and take parts of the jobs out.
Yeah. Yeah. You still got to have someone babysit the robots.
Exactly. But that's all that guy wants. That's all he cares about. Just drop those patties for me correctly.
Yeah.
So I think that's interesting. But yeah, I can see that.
I don't know. I don't know when we figure out how to make like a tube spit your food out, right?
That'd be sweet.
Not that I want to automate servers. That's not what I'm saying. Just like, let them do the people interaction stuff, and then if it can get the food can get flown from the kitchen to the table, then cool, right?
I've seen that. I would actually go the opposite way. So like in Europe, we were in England a couple of years ago, and you go into this restaurant, and I mean, it's a big restaurant, probably got 40, 50 tables in there, and they got three bartenders working, a food runner and a cook. And you go up to the bar, you order your beers and your drinks there. In London, gin was a big thing, so we got some gin. And like, we had the family with us, and we went in, and then we ordered our food right at the bar. They had us a menu, and then they brought our food out. And then like, I don't know, an hour in, some guy walked through and, you know, offered us another round of drinks, but that was it. I mean, and like, but then it was just totally okay. Like, no one seemed bothered by it. And this is downtown London, like high end area, no servers, just a food runner, a couple bartenders.
Yeah.
But I've seen that. I see it all the time coming out of China. Like, I'll see videos on YouTube or like on LinkedIn of like, you know, like a conveyor system swinging across the top. But I mean, I will tell you that, and this is the scariest part of the labor shortage. And I don't think people care, but if the labor shortage goes on too long, then more and more investments into augmentation and automation of these jobs is going to take place in the industry. And the place where all of us started and got our first jobs, I mean, I was 14 making cheesesteaks, that's not going to be available for our kids. You know, it's going to be less available, like retail and all these things that are kind of getting smashed right now. Those were the jobs that you got to learn how to have a job. And I worry about that.
Yeah. And if it's, you know, if the industry standard is to invest in, you know, robots, whatever versions of those we imagine that will be the standard, yeah, then the startup costs for new restaurant businesses, you know, you can't just have your cousin come in and work a couple extra shifts while you're getting your feet on the ground and building a customer. You've got to invest in all these robots. I can't imagine how that's going to be a barrier to entry to people, but you know, we probably got like a decade before that's a problem. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this guy, I got to bring him on the podcast. I got to introduce you to him. He's crazy smart. And he's got robots out there right now in Vegas pouring drinks. He's doing this test with the, at the pool bars in Vegas, the bartenders couldn't make the drinks fast enough to service all the waitresses couldn't service, or the servers couldn't service all the, you know, people at the pools. Mm-hmm. And so he can, you know, order the drink, it's done in 4 seconds. It's like, ow, pick it up, go. It's crazy.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'll introduce you to him. He's a cool dude. Okay, so that's not four. We're out to the end of the podcast. Number five question, give me a war story. I need a funny, cringeworthy story. Doesn't have to, you don't have to name names, but like just something that's like, I can't believe I got through that. Well, wow, that's amazing. Yeah.
Ooh, I should have given this more thought. I don't, it's not the funniest. It's a funny story. I think when I was getting my arms wrapped around different departments in Timeforge and learning the product and getting to know our customers, I was working on support and helping with support. And we had this lady call in who was really upset that our software had broken her computer. So it's a web software. Like, there's nothing to install. Like, there's nothing local. And so we were really confused. And of course, I'm terrified because I wasn't technical. And so I loop in all of the smart brains and we spend like half a day with like our best people trying to figure out how our software crashed her computer and locked her computer screen down. She couldn't do anything. And finally, after like, I don't know, 4 to 6 hours of troubleshooting, we finally figured out that her mouse battery had died. That was it. She couldn't move her mouse. That's why her computer was locked, was she needed to replace the battery.
Which nobody wants to hear this, but never listen to customers when they have customer problems.
No, we were, that was our bad. That was totally our bad. We, you know, I just assumed the worst possible thing could have happened did happen. And
Oh no. I do the same thing. As soon as someone calls in with a customer satisfaction, customer success, or like customer platform issue, I'm always like, oh my God, the whole, like, my initial thought is, oh my gosh, the whole system's down. We're crashed. Oh no. And then I'm like pulling up my, I'm like, I have my phone out. I'm like pulling up the app, and then everything works fine. And I'm like, okay. But no one in a million years would be like, hey, did you put batteries in your mouse? Like, that's a ridiculous thing that like, think about what that cost you though. Like, if you say 5 or 6 big brains, let's say if they were consulting, they would have been $150 an hour.
Right. You know,
4 hours, it's like $2,000 to help that lady figure out. And of course, none of those people would in a million years even, like, that wouldn't even occur to them. No. And also, the way she explained it probably was all jacked up too. Like, she never said, my mouse isn't moving and I can't do anything. Like, you know, like, you know how far, how many questions you asked that lady before you guys got to, was your cursor moving? Like, 1,000 questions.
Oh yeah,
that's insane. Yeah, no, yeah, I like, my business partner is always like, dude, you gotta, like, he's like, you gotta just, like, go, like, take a breath, slow down. Because what I also find too, when you have those technical problems, is that it's almost like the 7 stages of grief. Like, this should be, I don't know what exact stages they are, but like, it's similar to that, where like, you're like, hey, I'm doing this thing, I'm feeling good, this should be working. Why isn't this working? That's where it's not working. Then you start to get stressed. And it, and I know, look, I can't classify them, because I used to code too. But there's a point where eventually, after all the stress and anger, like, hits its pinnacle, and you're ready to throw your, like, keyboard against the wall and kick your monitor, that you then, like, go and you walk away and you take a breath. It's always when you, like, do that and you step away for 5 minutes and you come back, you find the answer, like, in 3 seconds.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Yeah.
But you just get so stressed that, like, it's just, like, this thing, like, emotional thing inside your body. And you're like, ah! And you can't focus or make good decisions. It's nuts. That's a good one. I like that. They're mouse didn't have batteries. That's a great story. If you listen to the podcast, this other guy had one where, like, a rat got stuck on a sticky trap and, like, ripped itself in half and then dragged its bloody body, like, through, like, a very fine dining restaurant in the town. That was a good one too. And, like, people puked and, like, it was insane. Like, it hit a glue trap. They had knocked down this giant old warehouse in Georgetown to build the Ritz-Carlton, and it sent, like, a billion rats into Georgetown, like, fleeing. And so they could, like, that whole summer, like, rats were everywhere. And so they put, like, they had glued glue traps to the floor. So the rat hit the glue trap and kept pulling himself off, ripped himself in half, like in a horror movie, and then just dragged himself through the dining room during service, like, on a Friday night.
Jeez. Oh, that's, man. That's a
checklist right there. Yeah. If you don't have a checklist that tells you to check for that, then you don't know. Yeah, man, you've been there 35 years. You got to go look at that rat trap and make sure that guy's not going to rip himself in half. Well, Audrey, this is awesome. I feel like we've talked a couple of times prior to the podcast, but I feel like we were, like, on the same page here, and we're becoming good friends. So
I
want to thank you for taking your time to come out here today and hang out with me for 90 minutes, even though I know we went 30 minutes over. I hope you didn't miss any other calls, but, oh, so by the way, real quick, also for everybody, that was a great wrap up, right? I'm telling you, I got to get this ADD meds back. I need to get the links to those studies, and then I'll put the TimeForge link on this site as well.
So yeah, people totally
can link to it and come check all that stuff out.
Perfect.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Audrey. Check out TimeForge, guys, if you're looking for some scheduling software and stuff, and I will put links up to everything. And thank you guys for listening to the Order Up podcast.
Thanks for having me, Tommy.
Oh, you're so welcome. Bye.
Bye.